Good evening. Good evening, and thank you for waiting. My name is Peter Berg. I'm Assistant Director for Special Collections here in the MSU Libraries, and I would like to welcome you to our ninth fall of the Michigan Writers Series. Our guest tonight is Jim Daniels, and before John Beck introduces Jim, I just want to say a few words about the Michigan Writers Series and how we work things here. Jim will read for about 45 minutes or so and then be available for questions, a few questions afterwards. As with all Michigan Writers Series events, the events are taped. They are then digitized and put on our website so that if this is a really, really good reading and you really like it a lot, you can come back and listen to it at your leisure, whether you're here in town or traveling throughout the country. We're very excited about that, and we have been doing that, as I said, for the last 9 years, and now I think we're up to about 80 or 90 writers with important ties to Michigan who have visited the campus as part of the Michigan Writers Series. There is a schedule of future writers coming to the Writers Series this fall, including two winners of last year's Michigan Notable Book Awards, Keith Taylor and Allison Swan, so I hope you can make it back for those events. They're always on Friday nights, and you can pick up a flyer on your way out if you would like. One final thing, too, and this is also for Jim. At about 5 minutes to eight or so, there's kind of an annoying announcement that'll come out over the PA out in the hallway announcing that the copy center is closing and whatnot, and it can be a bit distracting. But it's part of our culture here, and there's nothing I can do about it. So we just go with the flow and know that it's a consistent part of the Michigan Writers Series. And fortunately, the writers have been very good-natured about the whole thing. But that's just a little bit of a warning for you. So without further ado, let me introduce to you John Beck, who heads our very successful our daily work, our daily lives on campus, and also from the School of Industrial and Labor Relations, who will introduce Jim Daniels, and may I just say what a pleasure it is to have Jim back on campus. Thank you.
Now, in talking about Jim, it's hard to be brief, but I'm going to be absolutely brief so that I get out of the way and let Jim come up. I first met Jim in 1981 when working at the University of Michigan. We had there another thing similar to our daily work, our daily life, called the Program on Workers' Culture. Jim had just recently come out with a book called Factory Poems, his first book of poems in 1979, followed by another book called On the Line. These books were very, very important books, kind of in the history of worker poetry here in the United States, because it crystallized for a lot of people how the best of poetry could describe the workplace. And they were freeing books for many people. I think a lot of folks look back on Jim's work very fondly in relation to being some of the first stuff that they read that allowed them as workers to write and to begin to really explore what kind of things that they could do with words about their experience. Jim came out of an auto worker family with a variety of different relations who worked in the auto plants. He worked himself at Ford Motor Company and was a member of UAW Local 226 as part of his overall formative experience. He received a Bachelor of Arts from Alma College in English, followed by an MFA at Bowling Green in creative writing. Jim has really looked at for some time now the transition, his own transition, in relation to becoming, as he said in one of his poems, the tenured guy. That is what it means now to be a university professor. But he still keeps one foot inside his blue-collar working class roots and background and world, and now one foot in the world of academe. And quite a world of academe he's been able to really rise within. He's now the Thomas Stockham Baker Professor of English at Carnegie Mellon, where he runs a creative writing program, a very good creative writing program with eight faculty. And for a college that size to have eight very, very wonderful creative writers is quite something. He's gotten prizes for his teaching, for his poetry, individual poems, for poetry books, for his films, and for fiction books. So an unbelievably gifted person in relation to the kind of work he's done. even though he came out with one book in 1979, as I've been kidding him for the past 2 days, he managed to come out with four books in the last 12 months. Two of them have recently been published in the last month and a half. So unbelievably prolific. And much more importantly, the body of work, when you look back on it, is impressive in its depth, impressive in its voice, and in its reach, the amount of people that have been touched in one way or another by the work of Jim Daniels. Again, I already told you about the co-sponsors. We thank all of them for bringing Jim to campus. So please join me in welcoming Jim Daniels.
Thank you, John, and thank you all for coming. Sorry for the delay, but we just had a little mix-up. I was in the wrong place. But I'm here now. Thank you. And I appreciate you coming out on a lovely Friday evening in mid-Michigan. I thought this evening I would start out reading a short story from the new collection, Mr. Pleasant, and then read some poems. This story is called United States Street Football. And I don't think I really need to say much about it. I spent most of my formative years in Warren on the edge of Detroit between 8 and 9 Mile Road. And this is set there. United States Street Football. The fat... excuse me. Can't even get the first line right. The flat, crumbling streets of our subdivision were laid out in a basic, unimaginative grid, except for the odd twist where Rome Street turned into Pearl Street and vice versa, crisscrossing like the passing routes we ran in the middle of the street in front of our house on Rome. We played two-hand shove, not two-hand touch. This was in large part due to Angelo Diogenes' habitual protestation of, "You only got me with one hand." Our only alternative was to shove him into a parked car or, if he was lucky, over the curb onto the grass in order to emphasize the second hand. But the day Angelo was hit by Pete Broney's speeding Pontiac Firebird and slow-mowed his way up into the air and bounced off the windshield, as Pete swerved and kept going, a police car in hot pursuit, we had to change the rules once again and forever. The Free Press reported that the accident occurred on Pearl, and of course they were wrong. No reporter even came out to look at the sparkling sweep of broken windshield glass. If we hadn't witnessed it ourselves, we could have half imagined that the glass was evidence of simple vandalism and that Angelo would soon be showing up at our side doors with his scuffed-up football clutched in his arm, calling us out for another game of United States Street Football. The paper story was all about Pete Broney, who eventually ran aground in the weedy, ambiguous yard of the old farmer and his wife, who at one time had farmed the entire neighborhood before selling it off to developers. The piece of land they were left with was never clearly defined. Did they own the empty field behind the house, the vacant lot next door? All that was certain was that they were dying, were nearly dead, and they were scared out of their minds by the sirens and flashing lights of the emergency vehicles tearing ruts into their weedy yard. I never saw either of them ever again. Pete had nearly killed his girlfriend, Donna Monaco, earlier that afternoon, smashing in her head with a blunt object that was never found, though we all guessed it was a billy club Pete had made in shop class the previous year before he dropped out. A billy club hollowed out and filled with lead. In wood and metal shop at Warren Woods High School, the craft of weapon-making was honed and refined under the bleary, bloodshot eyes of Mr. Ernie Cook, who in the imagined privacy of his adjacent office drank himself into oblivion every afternoon. The drunker and or more hungover Ernie was, the more oil he put on his slicked-back hair, as if he just oiled it enough, some would sink through to kickstart his brain or maybe simply relieve the endless headache of his life. While it's not true that we blamed all our troubles on the blacks from Detroit, they were a convenient target since none of us actually knew any black people. Our neighborhood was 50% Polish Catholic and 50% Southern redneck, 100% white. All the rumbles in our neighborhood, brutal as they were just scrimmages for the battles with blacks we imagined having, though they never took place. Borders were respected. Well, we imagined they were threatening to cross 8 Mile Road and invade our neighborhood. In reality, we had little they would have wanted. The one place where the races mixed was at the factory, and according to our fathers, even there the departments were segregated. Pete had claimed he'd made the club to hit random black people who might inadvertently stray across 8 Mile, but he'd ended up using it on Donna. Donna, one of the most beautiful dark-eyed foxes to ever sashay the sidewalks of Warren. I cringed, imagining her destroyed face as she lay in a coma at Marigold Hospital. Angelo dead and Donna Monaco vegetized, all because Pete Baroni found out that Matt Ropp drove her home from a high school dance while Pete was pumping gas at Davy's 8 Mile brake service. Man, I said to my brother Steve, why can't Pete just back his car up all the way to his house and it could still be third down? Steve was 10, I was 13. Transmission problems, Steve said. The one thing we all knew about was cars, how they worked, how they didn't work, what kind we were going to drive someday. We'd already stopped riding bicycles, thinking they were for little kids, though for at least a couple more years we had no alternative except to walk or to hope some older guy would take mercy on us, which Pete had done on many occasions, letting a gang of us pile into his Firebird and cruise the streets and smoke cigarettes, giving us that harsh burn in our throats we associated with getting older. It was really messing with our heads that our hero had gone and run down our friend and done a horrible thing to a beautiful girl. I'm still trying to figure out what happened to Pete Baroni and to us, for we aspired to be Pete Baroni. Though it is true that most kids in other neighborhoods aspired to kick Pete's ass, instead, he was our Pete, and we had been his loyal followers. Steve picked at his fingernails crusted with dirt, the peculiar black grit that collected against the curbs of our neighborhood, some obscure residue from the GM plant down on Ryan Road. I'd seen him collecting small, shiny pieces of safety glass from the street. Neither of us had spoken Angelo's name, even when we went to the funeral. The funeral, we called it. Not Angelo's funeral. We never said Angelo. We never said dead. Sometimes we got rides from Ricky Arnold, but Ricky was such a homely dork that he never knew where to drive us. He wanted us to be his pals, and that was creepy. Pete was aloof. He had style. Now get out of here, you runts, he'd say to us, dropping us off on some random corner when he saw a cute girl he wanted to pick up. We'd taken to bombing Ricky's car with ice balls during the winter. He drove a lame little Volkswagen Beetle. He was never going to catch us, so we could afford to be mean. Meanness and cruelty were generally valued, fell under the umbrella of being tough. Tough luck, tough titty, tough. He had to be tough. I never heard my father use the word sensitive. It had too many syllables, with too little substance. The day after the accident and before the funeral was endless. My father went to work like any other day. My mother spent the morning in hushed tones on the telephone. Mr. Glubicki, who lived next door to Angelo's house, raised his American flag. His solution to anything was to fly the flag. He viciously hoarded our balls that landed in his yard and barked like a dog if we set one foot on his perfect lawn. Well, God bless America, my mother said sarcastically when she looked out the window and saw the flag. Asshole, she said under her breath. I didn't want to leave the house and see any of the other guys, but I didn't want to stick around the house either. Steve and I shared a room. He was spending the day sitting on his bed and sorting old baseball cards into various configurations. I'd stopped collecting them, and so had Steve. But he had held on to his old ones, and maybe he was taking comfort in their worn familiarity. I'd given him my old ones a couple of years back, and I felt a strange pang of jealousy watching him handling them, lost in some secret world. They hadn't yet built the Bronco Lanes bowling alley on the field where we played baseball, and that's where I went. One of two semi-natural spaces left in the neighborhood, a field that had been leaped over in the rush to develop the land around the factories more than 30 years earlier. Maybe the farmer hadn't sold that one odd piece out of some perverse loyalty to the land, or maybe somebody with a dream had bought it and was stubbornly holding on to the land, even though the dream itself had become abandoned and weeded over. I wandered through the hard, brittle weeds of October, kicking stray rocks. The wind, with nothing to block its path, barreled over the flat land and stung my face, penetrated my thin fall jacket. Part of being tough meant you didn't bundle up for cold weather. You jammed your fists into your jeans and said, "Fuck, it's cold," but you took it. You wiped your nose in your sleeve and cupped your red ears in your hands, but you took it. I kicked the ground again, and a heavy waterlogged ball from some previous season emerged. We still occasionally smacked the ball around back there, and it rolled briefly away from me. I picked it up and hurled it as hard as I could, though it landed harmlessly, well short of Ryan. When we played then, Tony Bruno had to bat left-handed so he wouldn't hit one into the traffic on Ryan. It seemed like we were outgrowing everything all at once. Our neighborhood was so bland and anonymous that the Pearl/Rome confusion was a source of pride, our one claim to fame, to live on the street that changed names. On the other side of the woods, our other natural space, an undeveloped patch behind Pioneer Meadows, Rome and Pearl continued briefly, then stopped at DeQuinder, the next big road parallel to Ryan. If you want to figure it out, just draw a square. Ryan and DeQuinder are on two sides, and 8 Mile and 9 Mile, the other sides. The story is that square mile. For if you lived outside that square, we didn't know you. It's called South Warren in a disparaging way, a euphemism for white trash, though we didn't consider ourselves trashy. White, though, definitely white. Three trailer parks were located within that square mile. A lot of people trying to get over the invisible speed bump of class and into a clean new life with lots of space around it. Invisible, but enormous. All the horsepower in the world wasn't going to get them over it. Occasionally, some stranger would stop and roll down the window to ask, "Boys, am I on Rome or Pearl?" To give bad directions, that was a big thrill. Angelo was our best improviser. He'd hitch up his pants, lean over the window, and direct some poor stranger into the bowels of suburbia. We couldn't get them too lost since we lived so close to 8 Mile Road. Everybody knew 8 Mile, the border between Detroit and Warren. We couldn't send them in that direction. But if we kept them on the identical anonymous side streets, they'd be busy for a while. Sometimes they'd even circle back to us, angrily stopping to curse as we scattered. Scattering was difficult in our neighborhood, whether you were on foot, on bike, or behind the wheel of a car. When everything is squared off, where are the shortcuts? Pete had tried to take a shortcut to revenge. Why didn't he go after Matt Ropp in a fair fight? The Pete we knew would never bash in a girl's head, but the Pete we knew never existed. He was the exhaust fumes of our imagination. Fence climbing was a revered art form in our neighborhood. Pete had been a championship fence climber. He needed that skill often, since he frequently found himself escaping some irate father or a mob of teenagers from another neighborhood. Pete could push himself up and swing his legs over in one easy motion, while the rest of us were busy sticking our feet in and out of gaps between the wire mesh to get ourselves up and over the bar while some mad dog nipped at our pant legs. I believe Pete had some special dog thing going. The same dogs that would tear their teeth through my pant legs as I tried to escape would just wag their tails and watch him, almost as if they were hoping that he'd stop to chat or pat them on the head or something. Dog eat dog, dog meat. Pete was dog meat now. If we'd had a chance, we'd have swarmed over him like mad birds or killer bees, swarmed over him and brought him down. Some of us had made our own clubs. United States street football was a league we created of 12 three-man teams. There were only 8 players in the league, me, Ralph, Tony, Angelo, Jimbo, Paz, Stan, and Ziggy, so we were all on more than one team. This made scheduling particularly difficult, but we developed a complicated set of rules for substitutions and exceptions that no one ever wrote down, but that we all carried in our heads more firmly than any math facts from school. Sometimes friends from the fringe would join in, substituting for someone who was supposed to be on both teams. We called them special guest stars. Steve played when we let him. 3 years age difference doesn't seem like much, but back then it was a completely separate generation. Once, we got Pete to play. He'd only play quarterback, at least in part because he was wearing his shit-kicker boots and couldn't run very well. To make things fair, we had him quarterback for both teams. Pete liked to throw as hard as he could, even if it was just a short safety valve pass over the middle. He just about caved in my sternum with one of those. There were short bombs and long bombs, but everything was a bomb. We'd painted yard lines on the street and USSF on the 50-yard line, which got some of the neighbors really pissed off, but the cops who came out to investigate seemed to get a kick out of it. We did it as professionally as we could, but it was late at night and we were nervous about cars, so the paint was a little wobbly in places. The cops just laughed, got back in their car, and drove off. We weren't big on uniforms. We knew who was on what team. We had shirts scrawled with team names that we sometimes remembered to wear. It's not like we were going to get confused. None of us wanted to be on teams with uniforms and pads where everybody got the same haircut and coaches grabbed you by the face mask and spat in your face. In our league, everybody was a quarterback, receiver, or running back. No one had to disappear into an anonymous herd of blockers. We'd be disappearing into the factory in a few years, so we wanted to be stars while we could. No goalposts, of course. 10 touchdowns won the game. I can't remember how we did extra points. Maybe it'll come to me later. Right now, I'm back on the street looking at Angelo's body splayed half on the curb, half in the street. The football's in my hands. The police car that's been chasing Pete swerves to a stop. We're all running to Angelo, then stopping short. The cops seem briefly torn between continuing pursuit and helping him. They radio something, then push their way to the body. The boy, hurt bad, no pulse. Panic doors are swinging open, mothers emerging from houses drawn by the squealing tires and the awful thump. None of us touches Angelo's body. The mothers are running. They will do what needs to be done. We are ants attracted and repelled, confused by the dead body in the path of our short lives. It's Angelo. And there's his mother, the only divorcee on the street back then. Angelo is her man, my little man. She's screaming as if she's on fire, screaming and sprinting the length of the street like the sirens we're hearing in the distance, approaching. His mother struggling with one of the cops, twisting, pounding on his chest. Young cop, scared, no pulse. They let her through. Back up, everyone, back up now. I'm holding the football. Me, Ralph, Tony, Jimbo, Paz, backing up. Our mother's grabbing us, separating us. Pete. Everybody knew Pete. Pete's mother. There she is. There she goes. He didn't have to say his last name. Wailing in tears, but not mine. Angelo, dead. Angelo, dead. His football. A present from his rarely seen father. Almost new. In my hands. Dragged away to our porch. Stay there, my mother shouts. But I go to Ralph's and we stand. Together. Not a word. The ambulance takes Angelo and his mother. The crowd sprays in the ugly clusters. Everyone knew Pete's Firebird. Some go onto the next block to look at the wreck, the next cluster of vehicles. Siren City, USSF. Who let those kids paint this? Somebody who doesn't know Rome from Pearl asks accusingly. We did, angry mother. We did, so? My statement. We were playing football. He was going on a post pattern. The car swerved around the corner going 100 miles an hour and hit him. I couldn't say his name. I have nothing else to say. My mother sits with me on the couch, her arm around me. I do not complain. I begin then to cry and cry and cry, football in my arms. Around Halloween the previous year, we tied a dummy to a long rope and tossed it over the streetlight. We'd hide in the bushes and drop the dummy on passing cars. We nailed Pete's. It scared the shit out of him, and he was pissed off. But once he calmed down, he appreciated the quality of the prank. Nice one, punks, he said. Then got back into his car and squealed away. I can't remember if Angelo was with us that night. The dummy didn't last long. Those long drops ripped it open after a few free falls. Sometimes the truth is so bizarre, you don't stand a chance of anyone believing it. The sound was a lot different. Well, Ralph said, or hell. He lived next door, so I saw him the most. He was 1 year older. A week after Angelo's funeral, and we were tired of sitting around in our houses after school, even though our mothers had let us watch all the TV we wanted. Homework seemed pointless, and the teachers were cutting us slack. We didn't want any more slack. We wanted to play. But our parents had decided against any more USSF. The paint lines weren't going away, but we weren't allowed. The schedule was not mentioned. The final standings were not mentioned. I had stuffed Angelo's ball under my bed. I didn't think his mother would want it. She had been let off by an old aunt to live in her house in Hazel Park on the other side of DeQuinder, and there was no telling when or if she was coming back. My mother sent us down to rake the leaves from her yard. The Diogenes was one of the few houses on the block that did not have a garage, for when the garage builders were coming through the neighborhood, Angelo's parents were already divorced. That's why he was the only child on the block. His parents hadn't stuck together long enough to have more than one. I let Ralph's well, or hell, hang there for a while. I was still smelling Mrs. Diogenes' heavy perfume from when she'd hugged me at the funeral, still dizzy with the spinning nightmare of the past 10 days. "Yeah, what are we going to do now?" I said finally. End of October and getting too cold to sit on the porch like we were doing. My nose was running and I wiped it on the back of the sweatshirt I'd scrawled Raiders on. When I turned it inside out, it said Spartans. "Where's the ball?" None of the rest of us had a ball, unless you counted Paz's undersized, rubberized yellow football that we used in emergencies. It was always going to be an emergency from now on, but that didn't mean we couldn't play. "I'll go get it." I ran home and crawled under my bed. The ball was dusty, so I rubbed it clean. Dusty already. I ran back out and threw a long pass to Ralph, who jumped off his porch and caught it. "Touchdown," I yelled, a little too loudly, as if I hadn't used my voice at all since the accident. Pete's mother was the niece of the old farmer and his wife, so they'd moved into one of the first houses in the development back in the mid-50s, a corner house where Bruce bisected Pearl and Rome right where they crisscrossed. Pete was the oldest kid in the neighborhood, and that had given him added status to begin with. He was charged with vehicular homicide and attempted murder, and at least half a dozen other crimes I can't remember. He pleaded guilty, so none of us had to testify. Pete's parents had appeared briefly at Angelo's funeral, hushing all motion, all tears. The funeral of a child is the worst funeral in the world. We didn't know that at the time. We thought they were all that bad. The raw grief overcoming the stiff, antiseptic artificiality of the funeral home. At least Angelo had a closed casket. Donna Monaco had an open casket for the rest of her life. Donna was still in critical condition, though her parents thought to send flowers for Angelo. Flowers, useless flowers overflowing the cramped rectangle of the viewing room, a name I thought was creepy. I thought they would all be that bad, that they would all be that crowded, though I never saw a funeral home that packed ever again. It was Malinsky's funeral home over on Ryan. The police were out directing traffic, old man Malinsky running back and forth from inside to outside to keep checking on things. He even forgot to put out a cigar before he came back in, and the trace smoke lingered like old shit among the perfume of the flowers. On the other half of Rome, which was officially called Pearl, Donna Monaco recovered, eventually, more or less. Permanent brain damage and facial scarring, but she survived. She could never go back to school or get a job or live on her own. She used to walk to church every morning with her mother, though I have no idea what they prayed for, either of them. We'd pass them on our way to school. We never even said hi, though they didn't seem to mind. We turned away or looked down, at least I did, every single time. I don't know what her personality was like when she had one, but I do know that before she was incredibly beautiful, with long black hair that circled around her waist as she walked. Her features were sharp and her eyes piercing and fierce. I always felt when I saw her that she was one girl who was going to do exactly what she wanted, maybe even go to college, which was extremely rare in our neighborhood, no matter what street you lived on. I couldn't stand to see her looking like some stupid pet to be led by the hand. Her nose had been smashed in and they could only do so much with it. Her hair was short now, I guess to make it less trouble for her mother. Donna herself seemed incapable of caring about or dealing with her own appearance. It broke my heart to see her, and I was only 13, so when my heart broke, it broke pretty deep and with all sincerity. If she would have died, we all could have considered her a saint and gone on with our lives, but she lived and lived and lived. Ralph and I started playing with Angelo's ball. We devised a game on the front lawn where the object was to throw the ball high enough so that he could run across the entire yard in time to catch it. Every play was a touchdown or an incompletion. That's the way it was in our neighborhood. You either made a touchdown and got out of there, or you were never quite fast enough and eventually settled down to a steady job in a factory where you blocked for the big stars, whoever and wherever they were. Knowing it was Angelo's ball spooked me. I was torn between seeing it as a precious treasure and seeing it as a flying nightmare of my dead friend. I suddenly turned and hurled it over the low roof of the house where I knew it would land harmlessly in the backyard. Perhaps it would roll into a pile of dog shit, but that could be wiped off. "Let's get out of here," I said to Ralph, and he didn't ask where. He just followed and stepped beside me, and we wandered off, passing the three houses of our tragic trinity, Pete's, Donna's, and Angelo's, the three neglected yards, the three porches with white paint curling in the strips and falling to the ground. No matter who lives in those three houses, for us they'll always be Pete's, Donna's, and Angelo's. "Let's get out of here," I said again later, as we stood back in front of our houses where we had started. I was 13, so maybe I didn't know what I was talking about, but Ralph didn't question that either. Maybe he nodded silently before we went back into our separate houses. Mr. Glubicki got a petition started to straighten out the street names so Rome would stay Rome and Pearl would stay Pearl. But for the people who would be affected, it was too late. Mr. Glubicki lived alone, had always lived alone. So what did he know, him and his goddamn flag, him and his goddamn war medals, Rome and Pearl, Pearl and Rome, hesitation, corner, engine idling, somebody scratching his head, rolling down a window, someone politely asking for a way out. They weren't going to get a straight answer from any of us. The year after the accident, somebody put a small cross in the Rulaski's lawn near where Angelo had landed, but it was gone the next day. Nobody wants a cross like that in our front lawn, do they? When Pete's name did come up, we called him Baroni. He wasn't Pete anymore. I got rid of my billy club, burned it with the trash one night out behind the garage, though. It took a while. Everything took a while. The paint slowly eroded from the USSF so that by the time we were driving our own cars, the faint white smudges could have been anything. Ralph was our statistician, and he held on to the scribbled records on the wrinkled, rain-streaked, or tear-streaked pieces of paper. We could drive there now, to that same house, knock on the door, and Ralph would pull them down from an old shoebox and lay them out for us, explaining how to make 12 teams out of 8 players. Angelo's name on the sheets circled, surrounded by stars, wherever it appears. One day that February, Ricky Arnold beeped his horn at us, and we didn't throw anything at him, though there was plenty of chunks of ice handy from the plowed A&P parking lot. He pulled over the curb and opened the passenger door, and we piled in. So, thank you. Thank you, and I'll read a few poems for you from couple of these new books. Now, the title of this book, Revolt of the Crash Test Dummies, changed a couple times. The first title of this book was Boring White Guy, which, you know, I thought, I'll read this poem that inspired that title, but I thought it was a representative title. But the publisher said, I don't think anyone's going to pick up a book that's called Boring White Guy. But this was supposed to be the title poem, which is called You Bring Out the Boring White Guy in Me. So, if you don't get all the allusions in this poem, that should make you feel good, actually. You bring out the boring white guy in me, the Ward Cleaver in me, the Pat Boone in me, the Kmart in me, the Slurpee in me, the boiled hot dog, the mac and cheese in me, the Tang in me. You bring out the hamburger helper in me, the Twinkie, the cheese whiz in me. You bring out the bowling trophy in me, the student council in me, the parliamentary procedure in me, the missionary position in me. You bring out the canned vegetables, the jello in me, the training wheels in me. You bring out the lawn edger in me, the fast food drive-through window in me, the value meal in me, You bring out the white briefs in me, the cheap beer and weak coffee in me. You bring out the 15% tip chart in me, the sad, overweight weekend golfer in me. You bring out the ex-smoker in me, the jumper cables in the trunk, the flares and the red flag to tie to the window in me. You bring out the Tony Orlando in me, the canned situation comedy laughter in me, the elevator music in me, the medley of TV commercial jingles in me, the up with people in me. I've come to a complete stop at the stop sign. I've got my emergency flashers on. My doors are locked, baby, but I'm waiting for you. So that title didn't work. So then I had the idea to call the book American Dream. But then the publisher said, well, if anyone wants to find the book and Googles it, they'll get too many other things if they type in American Dream. So it's the first time I had to change a book title because of internet search issues. But I'm going to read that poem now, which is called American Dream. And it's set at the Henry Ford Museum, which I'm sure many of you have been to in Dearborn, so I don't have to tell you much about it. But when we went there, I was with my family in town for Christmas and took a family trip out there. They had this robotics exhibit up at the time, and there was this quote, which is the epigraph for the poem. Some of the jobs these machines replaced were difficult, boring, or dangerous. Others were good jobs that paid well and workers enjoyed. And then we came to this other exhibit, American Dream. My father, my children, my wife, and I were recruited to work on a toy car assembly line. My son placed the yellow plastic frame under the conveyor. My wife snapped the red body onto the frame. My father snapped the blue seats in. I pushed the front end on. My daughter cranked the conveyor, controlling the speed. We each had a small box of parts. The museum employee in her perky red vest started a Chaplin-esque soundtrack, and we began, working smoothly till she instructed my daughter to crank faster. And we got backed up, tossing half-formed cars to the side. Faster, she kept telling her. We ran out of parts just as the music stopped. The employee counted the good cars and the bad. Bad outnumbered good. My son asked if we could keep the cars. She said no. In fact, we had to take them apart so that others could put them together again. My father and I had worked on assembly lines where if you couldn't keep up, you were fired, where time controllers assessed how long each job should take and set the line speed. The family that took our places asked me to videotape the whole thing. I wish I could say I was making this up. Inside, I felt the old humiliation throbbing again in my stooped back. I hated this woman bossing my daughter around. I told her I wanted to see my union rep, trying to keep it light. But she had a script to stick to and was probably making a minimum wage herself. She didn't explain to us what we were supposed to take away from our experience, just not the cars. So the book ended up being called Revolt of the Crash Test Dummies, which is another poem which I won't read for you tonight, but I will read you this poem called Outdoor Chef, which was a course that my high school offered. Is there anyone from my high school here? Okay. Fitzgerald High. In the 70s, we had a course called Outdoor Chef, and this explains a little bit about that course. Nobody believes my high school offered a course called Outdoor Chef. The yearbook carried a picture of us firing up the barbecue in the parking lot. This was before the invention of the gas grill, before they raised the drinking age back to 21. Jimi Hendrix burned his guitar at Monterey, then died shortly after, bumming us out in Outdoor Chef. It was only a one-semester course, so we had to cram. Charcoal lighter was routinely abused. We spelled our names on the sidewalk and lit them like pissing in snow. Our teacher was Mrs. Reynolds, enormous and cheerful, and in retrospect, willfully ignorant and alcoholic. It was a difficult class to teach, no textbook. Mr. Farwell, our principal, needed higher graduation rates, courses to shunt problem kids into Not one fight in Outdoor Chef, despite having the toughest guys in the school bunched together around the grills. Class was often outside, even in winter. Class was often cut, long wild hair disappearing in the snow toward the parking lot. Joints often snake between us, smoke blending with burning meat. I learned a lot about cooking chicken and pork. See, those are important things. You can get sick not cooking them long enough and make others sick, too. Neighbors would never come over for a cookout again. My apron had some crude joke about a hot dog on it. So did everyone else's. I can't begin to express how clever we were. We cooked a whole turkey for Thanksgiving and served it to Mr. Farwell and Mr. Stark, the assistant principal hitman. He said he could have used a curse like that when he was in school. They did not get sick. It was a festive occasion until we let a live turkey loose in the main hallway. No girls in Outdoor Chef, though. You might have guessed that. The jocks were subdued and serious about remaining eligible. Our school had few jocks to spare. The rest of us were lighting each other's long hair on fire and thinking that was a fine joke. Okay, Eddie Bucco did get stabbed with a skewer, but we all agreed it was an accident. We enjoyed waving our hands above the hot coals. None of us bothered with winter gloves. The last day of class, Jackie Smoker brought in his cheap electric guitar and tried to imitate Hendrix's blasting from his nearby car radio. He messed up his hands bad, but for a while it was beautiful. Even now, I am full of self-mockery and loathing. The truth was that for many of us, having our own barbecue would indicate a successful life. Mrs. Reynolds had gone to college to teach home ec. We should have treated her better, her and everybody else. Yes, it's on my transcript with a C. Our final had some math on it. The wind blew ash and smoke into the air, just like at the factory down the road. We had to provide our own briquettes. There's an enormous number of things you can cook outdoors. The only class in which we believed what the teacher told us, because we could see that in gym class. We chewed gum outside and threw it against the school building. Mr. Farwell gave most of us diplomas. I don't know how many years Outdoor Chef was offered. You could not burn your marshmallow on the test. That, when all we wanted was to go up in flames. And I'll shift gears, and I will read you the title of this other title poem of this other book, In Line for the Exterminator, which is a dark roller coaster in an amusement park called Kennywood Park in Pittsburgh. And you have to wait in line in this very compressed space that ends up being pretty tense on a hot summer day. In Line for the Exterminator. Four skinheads swear in sweat and fat leather behind my son and me, looping around endless rows of steel rails in the fake cinder, the fake cinder block bunker. The ride simulates a trip through the bowels of sewers beneath the city. The skinny punks who cut in line jokingly press the panic button, a blaring echo that mimics nightmare alarms. They won't stop, though somebody's shouting, "Stop it!" Some young blacks with their girlfriends throw scowls at the skinheads. Perfume and deodorant and farts and spit and melting makeup and exposed skin pierced or not and tattoos and thick jewelry and tight clothing plastered against skin of all colors. My son is glassy-eyed with the room's menace. It stings, it clings. The line crawls like a whipped dog toward the dark door behind which it's promised we are all to be scared. A fake newscaster on a monitor describes a power failure. I want to ask, how many in this room make minimum wage? How many in this room will ever own a house? What if we made a giant wad of gum and rolled it out of this park and onto the front lawn of the richest motherfucker in the city? We've all paid our admission and had our hand stamped. Perhaps the walls are closing in on us. Hey, how many of you have been on this ride before? I'd like to read a little poem about my father called Balancing the Checkbook. My father's Dutch master's box contained a switchblade and a silver lighter, one antique condom, and his corporal stripes. a wrinkled picture of his dead brother, a pen from Niagara Falls, and a checkbook. A dead mouse and simmering self-loathing, a not-good-enough pin and a demerit slip, a night in jail and the phone number of a dead Irish lawyer, a scrap of paper scrawled, "Here's where things get interesting." An empty lipstick tube or a bullet, an empty church offering envelope, an unintelligible hiss. One cigar, 5 children, but we wouldn't fit. Nights alone at the yellow kitchen table, flipping through the stack, writing in the tiny lines, clicking the pen against the long neck beer. I'm 3 moons away, or hiding behind the sliding kitchen door, listening to him breathe. Everybody else asleep, and he's mine. Our planets aligned in the cold space, the moment the numbers add up for one night. Whatever's really in that box, shut away for another month, as he sighs, "Damn." The closest to amen we were ever going to get. This next poem is called "Chocolate for Football." It's about my short-lived football career. Chocolate for football. I drag myself door to door, clunky cardboard box banging off hip pads for CYO football, Catholic football, Catholic chocolate in long slender bars wrapped in gold foil. My own neighbors feigned a lack of recognition if they answered at all. I watch TV through their windows, October, Saturday afternoon, college games on. Doors slammed, smacked like shoulder pads. On my bike after practice, I drag my spikes over cement in the dark, sparks flying up and away like I was a super dude or Saint Fuck You Up. Helmet hung over my handlebars, cheap logo peeling off, mouth guard glowing fluorescent under spaced out streetlights, hoarse throat burning as my soul escaped in a gob of phlegm. They were replacing wooden bleachers with aluminum. They were reminding us we would live forever. We were asking for support. We had plain chocolate and chocolate with nuts. I was tired of getting knocked on my ass by good Catholic boys who played to win. I was in love with the moon and all reflected light. At dusk, I lugged my box to the weedy hollow in the empty field behind the bowling alley where we stashed our sins, magazines, and wine. I ate till I was sick and left the rest for rats and winos. I wore one of the strange high numbers of the uninspired. 3 cheers for Jesus, Mary, Joseph, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. I paid for the chocolate with paper out money. I egged the coach's house on Devil's Night. I faked the need to go and flattened the quarterback's tires. My extremities were extremely cold. I was blocking unsuccessfully for the school's illiterate fancy dancers, cheerleader idols, poster boy martyrs. Their saints were bigger than my saint. When I quit the team, I kept the only things that were mine, jockstrap, mouthguard, and spikes. If some night you were driving home from the Unimart with milk, bread, a six-pack, a carton of smokes, your cigarette lighter pressed in, waiting for the orange halo glow, and you saw a whirling miracle of sparks, I hope you crossed yourself, or smiled, or swore. That was me. This next poem is about just being a stupid teenager, like most of the other poems. This one is called Safety. And I was talking with John earlier, and there were a lot of teenage pregnancies in my school, and that's sort of the shadow over this poem. Safety. Stopped at a red light near the freeway. I opened a beer and threw the bottle cap out the window where it hit pavement and rolled. Where were we headed? I closed my eyes. The light changed. "Hold my hand," she said. "I can't," I said. "I'm driving." Some things you couldn't repeat in a million years. The bottle cap rolled right in the open door of Olar's last stop party store like a sperm shopping for an egg. I opened my eyes. At 16, you have to wait a long time for your head to clear. Forever, sometimes. Later we parked and professed our love. Our hands were blind. Would they ever get used to the dark? How far would we go? We talked about it like traveling when neither of us had been out of state. The police stopped, told us to keep moving. Stop or keep moving. Everybody telling us something different. We told more lies when we're 16 and we ourselves believe half of them, like, I'll be careful and I love you forever. It was a miracle she never got pregnant after all those long trips, crumpled maps littering the back seat. I never told anyone about the bottle cap. It was something to see. Luck doesn't begin to explain it. Looks like we have a range of ages here. So anyone remember the Sheik? Okay. He died. And this is an elegy for the Sheik, who was one of the notorious professional wrestlers that would be on Channel 9 Studio Wrestling from Windsor. And he was a native of Detroit. And I saw his elegy, his obit in the New York Times. And what it said in the obit was this quote, which is the epigraph for the poem. It said, "The Sheik's pioneering sadism clearly established his credentials." And that's why we loved him. Elegy for the Sheik. Oh, this is a sonnet, by the way. In a tiny TV studio in Windsor, the Sheik railed and raved. In our living room, we closed the drapes to cut Saturday afternoon glare. The camera withered under the Sheik's evil stare. On the lumpy couch, our father dozed, open-mouthed through our shouts and shrieks and other comforting sounds of home, roof leak and furnace groan. The Sheik's gory mumbled prose translated from gibberish by the weasel into a double dare to bowl of Brazil or bowl curry with a cauliflowered ears. The foreign object ultimately emerged at the close, stabbing a blood capsule open to please the studio freaks and geeks and us. Born in Detroit, Arab headgear notwithstanding, the Sheik did not make cars. He made his landings. Just two more poems here. I'll finish up. This poem sort of moves back and forth between Detroit and Pittsburgh. It's a hot night in the summer, laying in bed thinking of my mother lying in her bed in the same heat here. Breath from my mother, August. Night breaks, squeal in the sizzling street. The fan pants out stacked air. Somebody shouts, "Love ain't no joke." A bread wrapper festooned with stars, you rustled open to slap six lunches together, sandwich, 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 bread indented with your fingerprints, napkin and apple and pennies for milk. A siren and a moan, a siren and a moan, big mean dog chewing a big mean bone. I'm not praying. Just whispering cool air above the hot roofs, sending it the old way, no label or stamp. Rancid street heat, bodies half-heartedly vicious over the scraps. I try to tune in the voice believing in love. A Jeep's big speaker shakes the jitters in the concrete cracks. You love me, still alive with one lunch and six prayers, fruit softening, rotting. Who needs rain when we got sweat, when we got tears, salt on the lips and a wish, salt on the lips and a pistol raised? The moon swallows bullets, or maybe that's a myth. Hot there too, huh? Kick off the sheets and turn the pillow. No escaping the thumping bass of the world's grudge. Open your window wide and listen for me. And the last poem, set in Pittsburgh, and it has my kids in it. The same neighborhood and some of the same issues. It's called Flags. My children and I color the flags of imagined countries. We watch sleeping tenants across the street through sliding glass doors. Few bother with curtains. Few have anywhere to go for work. My son said cocaine for the first time, singing, "I get a kick out of you from anything goes." Last week we walked to town to see it. He's almost 7. She's 5. The names of our new countries are unimportantly clever, our little secrets. "Wake up, sleepyheads," we sing softly. They're not far away, the lives across the street. We're up early here. Our flags are sprinkled with kisses, eggs, eyeglasses, water, grass. My son has 3D glasses, my daughter a whoopee cushion. The instructions on my new socks say, "Do not eat." We use invisible glue and tape. An exterminator shows up across the street. My flag is a big bar of soap. The country of happiness soap. I can never keep a secret. I do not know their names across the street. Last week, someone lost his life over there. No flagpole within blocks of here, but perhaps 1,000 invisible borders. Excuse me for being imprecise. My daughter colors a flag of hearts, but we cannot give a name to our own country. Thank you. As Peter said, I'm now available to answer any questions that you might have and be happy to do so. Yes?
Were many of those earlier poems you read prose poems?
No. They're free verse poems. And I do try to pay attention to rhythm and structure, but it's more, each poem sort of picks up its own structure from the material. I work in form and out of form depending on what I think the poem calls for. Some other questions? Yeah.
Do you ever see people from the old neighborhood or the factory, and how do they regard you?
Well, tomorrow I'm going back to the old neighborhood, and I'll probably just see family because I have to go back to Pittsburgh on Sunday. But yeah, I keep in touch with a number of friends, and it's interesting because, when we were growing up and I started writing, we never really talked about writing much. And so when my last book of short stories came out, Detroit Tales, it was the Detroit Free Press book club selection. So there was a nice piece in the Free Press about it. And I came back and I saw my friends. And I said, "Hey, I saw that article about your book in the paper." But they don't read the book. and it doesn't hurt my feelings. I mean, it's just who they are. And the way we've always dealt with things. So in some way, I hope maybe that answers your question a little bit.
Yeah.
Some other questions or comments or anything? Yeah.
I don't know quite how to put this. The voice of the narrator in the first story, the 13-year-old boy, it sounded so mature, but a 13-year-old isn't mature and doesn't have sort of that reflection looking back at life yet, the detail that you put into it, rubbing the snot off your nose. And those are those moments of frozen time that you kind of remember from being that age that... Or did you just kind of dream these things, make these things up, looking back at it as an older person to that time? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because they're so very, very specific that, I can remember things that happened. And when you were telling that story or reading it, it reminded me of Jackie Leffler, this kid who was killed in an automobile accident that was in my classroom. So it generated a lot of that. And I don't know if you go into it just kind of through association. Happens to you to get those very specific images beyond just the story as you kind of remember it?
Well, the imagination's a strange and wonderful thing. And, so a lot of times one little thing will trigger a whole range of memories and associations. Mm-hmm. And they just, so it ends up being a kind of stream of conscious free association after a while. And so, there are various things that I can point to in that story that are very vivid memories, but the whole incident is really, it's fiction. But there are enough triggers in terms of things that really happened that I feel like they took me back there. And, you know, I think the streets of where we're from, no matter where we're from, tend to be really vivid and evocative places. So, you know, a rock in a field, to anybody else, it's just going to be a rock in the field, but for you, it'll turn on memories you didn't even know you had that were still in there. And so it's kind of fun to wander around and see what comes up.
Was that a true incident?
Not exactly, not really. It was kind of combined two or three different things that I sort of put together. And I think everyone, or most of us, particularly if we went to a high school of any size, there was some tragedy while we were going through school. And for many of us, it was the first loss beyond maybe grandparents. And so I drew on memories of that first loss and from a different incident that I've actually written about, which is a fire down the street, to recreate some of that. And certainly, you know, we used to play football in the street all the time. And there was the USSF. So there are certain things that I could say, oh, that's really true, and that I made up. But the main incident really didn't happen.
It's interesting because what it triggered in me is a real clear remembering of that time. You know, as you were reading the story, I was thinking about this young guy. He was just this gorgeous kid that all the girls had a crush on. He was lost. And it brought out a lot of not parallel things, but in a way that it was touching.
Thanks. I guess one of the emotional impetuses for that story was thinking back about how we romanticize the tough guys in ways that were probably not very smart.
Yeah.